Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Memorial Day with the concerns among the serving military and veterans groups that President Trump will pardon American war criminals who have been turned in by their fellow soldiers because Trump is influenced by Fox News hosts who are chicken hawks peddling macho military fantasies that real men murder defenseless non-combatants. Furthermore, our bone spur president, who avoided serving in Vietnam by having his father pay a doctor to give his son a phony medical discharge, for reasons that are mystifying, is being given a free pass by Republicans who piled on criticism of Bill Clinton about the way he avoided serving in Vietnam, as did liberal critics of George W. Bush, who questioned how the son of a prominent politician ended up in the Texas Air National Guard. A highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts, Dr. Philip Butler, who was shot down over North Vietnam in 1965, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war, joins us to express his disgust at the president's apparent intentions to pardon war criminals after having already pardoned Lieutenant Bahina, who was found guilty of murdering an Iraqi prisoner. We'll discuss the possibility that Trump will also pardon employees of Blackwater, a mercenary army founded by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos's brother Eric Prince, who were convicted in the 2007 killing of 4 Iraqi citizens in what became known as the Nisour Square Massacre. Then we will speak with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer who has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. The author of Come Back Alive and License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, he joins us to discuss the release of the unrepentant so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind, from prison, and describe the scene that he witnessed when Lind was captured in Afghanistan in November 2001, where a CIA operative was also killed by Lind's fellow prisoners. It turns out that branding Lind as a Taliban is erroneous, since, as Lind told Robert Young Pelton at the time of his capture, he was trained at a terrorist training camp created by Osama bin Laden and was a member of Al-Qaeda, not a Taliban fighter. And joining us on this Memorial Day is Dr. Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who has been awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And after his repatriation in 1973, he earned a PhD in sociology from the University of California at San Diego and became a Navy organizational effectiveness consultant. And he completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Philip Butler.
Good morning, Ian. Thank you for inviting me back on your show again. I can't think of anything I'd more rather do than be on your show for Memorial Day, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you for joining us. And what do you make of this eruption of objections from serving military and former veterans, and including the veteran who's running for president, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, about Donald Trump's plans to pardon a number of people that are clearly war criminals, the Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher among them, perhaps even some of the Blackwater people that Betsy DeVos's brother organized and ran that company, Blackwater. They murdered a bunch of civilians in Iraq. There's rumor that he'll also pardon them. So as a veteran, on this Veterans Day, how does it strike you?
Well, I just wonder how much more this guy could do that could be more disgusting than this stuff, this Navy Chief Gallagher, this Navy SEAL, his fellow SEALs, accused him of shooting unarmed civilians, and to get a Navy SEAL team to to come down on one of their kind, that guy had to be pretty disgusting, pretty horrible. And then we've got that, like you said, that Major Matthew Goldstein, the Army Green Beret, accused of killing an unarmed Afghan. At first they stopped this guy thinking that he might be carrying bomb materials, but then when they searched him and found that he wasn't, evidently this guy just assumed that this innocent Afghan was going to cause problems. So anyway, so he shot him. And then you got the Marine Corps squad who were urinating on corpses of dead Taliban. And this goes back to Trump pardoning Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's a criminal. I guess since the president is a criminal, it makes sense that he would pardon criminals.
Well, apparently the pressure is coming from Fox News, these kind of chicken hawk Fox News commentators. What impulse is there amongst these civilians to think that sort of macho to kill prisoners?
Boy, I can't for the life of me figure out where the Fox News people are coming from. They're just a bunch of crazies. And shamefully, that's where our current president gets all of his information and gets his direction from these crazy people, and he ultimately invites them to serve on his staff with him. So it is just about the nuttiest thing that this nation has ever seen. But if we have a little extra time, I'd like to say something about some incarcerated veterans that are pretty good guys, Ian.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you're doing some work trying to rehabilitate some Vietnam vets that are incarcerated, and we have an enormous homeless problem amongst vets, not just Vietnam-era vets who are now, in their 60s and 70s, but also Iraq War and Afghan veterans. And here in Los Angeles, you have a big VA campus in West Los Angeles, in Westwood, and in all surrounding it. In fact, all along the fence of the big VA campus, you've got homeless encampments. So there's a direct correlation there. So what is it about the way that all our politicians always say nothing is too good for our fighting men and women and our veterans, and yet, you know, you can see the neglect is staring you in the face?
That's a big load of baloney. But this story, my personal story, goes back 7 years, actually, on Memorial Day. Ironically, 7 years ago, I was invited to come down to Soledad Prison, which is about an hour or so south of Monterey, Soledad, California. And there are two prisons there, actually. There's a California training facility, which are the low risk level prisoners that have parole dates, and they are trying to rehabilitate those guys and get them out to making positive contributions as citizens. There's about 4,000 in that prison, and then on the other side of the prison, Salinas Valley Prison, the really worst of the worst are over there, the level one and two guys and gangbangers and killers and murderers and rapists and all the really, really bad people who are still acting out are over there. At any rate, on this Memorial Day, I was invited to come to CTF and be a keynote speaker for a Memorial Day celebration with incarcerated Vietnam veterans. And I learned that all of these guys have honorable discharges from their respective services, and they have quite an organization of incarcerated veterans. They actually have a company of these guys with their elected company commander and so on and so forth. But anyway, I was surprised that this beautiful flag ceremony that that they did. And when I started off my talk, I said to them that they all knew that I had been incarcerated as a prisoner of war and that I had served incarcerated 8 years. And I wondered how many of my fellow Vietnam veterans, about 70 of you, how many of you have been incarcerated for more than 8 years? And every hand in the room went up. Mm-hmm. And then I said, let me ask you this. Are there any of you guys here who came home from war and were so full of post-traumatic stress that you murdered your wife's boyfriend, who she had taken up with while you were gone, or you murdered your wife, or you murdered both your wife and her boyfriend when you came home? And about 25 hands went up in the room.
Good Lord.
And so I told him, I said, you know, it just shows how close we are, guys, how close you guys are to me, because I came home and it turned out that I had guns from my previous life there, and my wife had a boyfriend, and I thought seriously about doing a wrong thing to her with a gun and her boyfriend, but luckily I didn't do it. I had control of myself enough that I didn't do that, even though I was filled with anger, because she immediately divorced me and even told me not to come to my house while I was in the hospital, told me not to come home to the house because it would embarrass her boyfriend. So, you know, the other thing that I've learned as a volunteer down there with these guys coaching and mentoring now for the last 7 years is that there are a lot of really good people who have been incarcerated for 25, 30, 35 years. I recently talked to a man who had been incarcerated for 45 years, and he's had perfect behavior for 45 years. He was given 30 years to life, and he's still in prison after 45 years. And the reason for it, Ian, is prisons in this country are a big, big business. And it's in the business's best interest to keep people incarcerated and not to let them get out. I've also come to serve as on the Community Action Commission for both prisons with the wardens and other staff members. And when I drive over there to go to our meetings once a month, you just can't believe the cars that are parked around those prisons. Now, bear in mind, there's 10,000 men in these two prisons. There must be well over 10 or 15, I don't know, 15,000 cars parked out there, because there are so many people who are employed in these prisons. It's just astounding. You just have to see the parking lot to see what it's really like, for real, you know. Sure. Everything is done by corporations. All the food service, all the stores, all the laundry, just everything you can think of now is done by civilian contractors, just like we're starting to be with the military these days. So war and prisons are our biggest businesses in this country, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, who is a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace, and as he's just explained, he also works on rehabilitating prisoners, in particular Vietnam War vets who have been incarcerated for long periods of time. And of course, adding to the what's called the prison industrial complex, along with the military industrial complex, Phil, in the state of California, in Sacramento, the capital, the biggest lobby is the guards, the prison guards union. So it's not just a corporate thing. We're spending so much money that the prison guards are a powerful union. And I'm not sure what they're – you work with these guys. Do they want to keep the gravy train running, or do they want to try and get these guys rehabilitated and out of prison?
Well, the place that that I volunteer, it's just CTF, the California Training Facility, and I volunteer, as I said, with the veterans and also with other prisoners. I honestly think that as far as California prisons go, that's probably the best. It's the only CTF in California, and its mission is to rehabilitate people, as opposed to all the other prisons all up and down California, you know, dozens of them, where the mission is not necessarily to rehabilitate people, but at least they're trying to rehabilitate these guys. And the CTF that where I volunteer, there are over 100 activities that the guys can get involved in, including all sorts of therapy type things and group therapy things, and so they do that. But it seems to come from Sacramento that the hold is on these guys. I mean, these guys will may have served 30 years after a 25-year life prison sentence, and they have a parole date that's maybe a year or two out, but they seem to just go through these parole dates. They'll go to a parole hearing, and then they'll come back to the prison, and nothing happens. And then they get their parole denied, and then they have to wait another 2 years. They have them in 2 year increments. So then in another 2 years, they go out for another parole date. And it just doesn't make any sense, because these guys have had zero blemish on their behavior as prisoners. I mean, they're really good people, and they have an extremely low recidivism rate. And these are guys that you'd want, you know, in your neighborhood or working in the business where you work, because they've really learned a lot, and they really know a lot about themselves, and they really, above all else, want to make a contribution. All they can talk about is they want to make a contribution when they get out. Many of them have made great contributions while they're prisoners. They're always having fundraisers of one sort or another, and the fundraising is for nonprofits that are around the outside communities around them. So just tens of thousands of dollars that they create in these fundraisers for nonprofits. So I tell you, a lot of these guys I see are really good guys, and they should be out making contributions in society. And they should be voting, too. There are 10,000 prisoners down there in Soledad. They're all citizens of the county, of Monterey County, and they can't vote. I don't think that's right either. I think they all should be able to vote, and certainly people who come out of prison should be allowed to vote. States like Florida, where they prohibit voting, is just insane.
Well, Dr. Philip Butler, let's take a brief station break, and on this Memorial Day, we'll be back in a minute or so, continuing the conversation with Dr. Philip Butler.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. Sit there facing the hill. Just say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Dr. Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he's completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. So we do have a veteran. Obviously, it's a pretty crowded Democratic field. But we have an Afghan vet running, and he, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and he's doing very, very well for a relatively obscure guy. Suddenly he's up there, not in the very top tier, but he's sort of making his way up there. And frankly, I've never seen a political candidate that's so articulate and so thoughtful. He speaks in a way that I'm envious of. I'd like to write as well as he speaks. He speaks in really precise and very elegant sentences. So he's quite an interesting guy. But he did a Fox News town hall recently, and as you know, Phil, a number of the
I saw part of that. That was cool.
Yeah. Well, you know that Elizabeth Warren and other Democrats have refused to go on Fox, but He took those people right on, and obviously in politics it's stupid to insult voters, whether you agree with them or not. Your job is to win them over. And he won a lot of people over. But what he did do, and I don't know whether this will become a campaign theme, he took on Trump as the bone spur president and basically made the point that the guys that you're talking about that have been incarcerated for 30, 40 years, the Vietnam vets, they served in Donald Trump's place. That's the part of the story that's not told enough.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And these guys all served honorably, and some of them were combat veterans and some not, you know, just like veterans around. In fact, if you look at all the veterans of Vietnam and of World War II or any war, you know, the vast majority did not serve in combat, but served in some other capacity for their service. But nevertheless, I think the guy is articulate, and he does have, having been a veteran, going for him, and any Democratic candidate. The job number one is to take on Trump for all the idiotic and horrible, disgraceful stuff that he's been doing, and just how he is as a person. And so they definitely have to take him on. But I have to say, I haven't made up my mind of the 20 or so candidates that are running, except that I do hope, and this is just a personal thing, I hope Joe Biden gets out of the way. I think there are lots of younger people that are more articulate and probably will be better qualified to be a president than Biden. Biden has a habit of stumbling over his own speech and his own tongue and saying dumb things, sort of, you know, impromptu stuff that he pops out with that we could have less of, that's for sure. So anyway, I'd like to see some of these younger people have a shot at being our president. And I guess I'd love to see a woman do it as well. I think that would be good for us to finally elect a woman as our president.
So you can have a woman on the top of the ticket and a gay vet as the VP, right?
That's right.
A dream ticket. Yeah. Welcome to the new America. So, yeah. Phil, why is it, though, that, again, that Trump's shameful draft dodging and having his father hire this doctor to come up with a bone spur to get him out of Vietnam? And then he was on Howard Stern saying that Trump said, my Vietnam was all the VD that I contracted from the many women I was bedding. So that was his take on Vietnam. But remember how much grief Bill Clinton got over letters to his draft board to get out of Vietnam?
He certainly did.
The Republicans piled on.
They were after the Clintons constantly for one thing after another, you know.
Right, and then
Whitewater, or on and on and on. They've always been after them.
Right, and then but the liberals also were after George W. Bush about his joining the Texas Air National Guard to avoid going to Vietnam. So why is it that George W. Bush was raked over the coals over his not going to Vietnam, and Bill Clinton was as well, and yet Donald Trump, the Republicans are giving Donald Trump a free pass? They're not even bringing it up, you know.
Yeah, well, they're afraid of him. They're gutless. They have no courage. All these Republicans in Congress now that won't take on these outrageous things that President Trump is doing. They just they're fearful. They're afraid. They saw one guy, lose his job, and above all else, the most important thing, their mission number one is to keep their job in Congress, no matter what it does to our country. It could destroy our country. They don't care. All they want is to stay in their job, and they're afraid of Trump, that if he says things in their district about them, that they'll lose their job. So it's just lack of courage. It's just gutless people.
So back to the Trump sort of musing over pardoning a bunch of war criminals. Lieutenant Bahima is one of them. He's already been pardoned by Trump.
Right, yeah.
He shot a prisoner dead, and I don't know why Trump pardoned him. And as I mentioned, it's likelihood that he'll pardon these Blackwater employees who were convicted of killing 14 Iraqi citizens in 2007. And it was an absolutely brutal thing that they did, just indiscriminately mowing down civilians in a town square. And that company, of course, was owned by Eric Prince, the brother of Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, a good Christian, I might add. What can be done as a veteran and amongst veterans organizations to stop this? Because it's not just Mayor Pete. Many, many veterans have gone public expressing outrage at the possibility of these kind of people being pardoned by President Trump.
Well, yeah, I think it's time for veterans to come out and to speak out and to be active and even to run for political offices wherever you might be, wherever you might live. I'm a little bit past my time for running for political office. I think if I were 20 years younger, I would strongly consider it. But at age 80, I think I'm a little bit past that now. But I would encourage veterans from all wards, those who having served in the military, that you learned a lot of things that other people don't learn, like teamwork and getting along with people and making decisions by working together with people who maybe think a little bit different from you and look a little different from you. But you never get anything done. It's like having been a prisoner of war. People ask me, well, how I survived as a prisoner of war. And I tell them the short answer is that being a POW is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. And that's how I and all of us survived, is through our teamwork and working together with each other to resist, which I think I try to bring out strongly in my book.
And give me the title of your book.
Three Lives of a Warrior.
Three Lives of a Warrior?
Yes. You can get three is spelled out, T-H-R-E-E, Lives of a Warrior.
Right, and that you can get that on Amazon?
Yes, it's on Amazon, and it's on my website at philipbutlerphd.com.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, just to go back to the idea of pardoning war criminals and, you know, the paradox, of course, being that we hear all of our representatives saying nothing is too good for our vets. But, you know, as I mentioned, you know, drive by the VA in Westwood and you see all these homeless vets sleeping along the outer fence, and enormous amounts of money are spent. But now we have, at the head of the Department of Defense, a defense contractor. a guy from Boeing whose job was to sell, you know, aircraft to the Defense Department. Now he's the Secretary of Defense, and Trump's very happy with him because he likes, you know, acting secretary so they don't have to be confirmed. Where, you know, if he were confirmed, of course, he'd be asked some pertinent questions about his loyalty to the United States or to the Boeing Corporation. So we're spending more on defense today than we spent at the height of the Cold War, when we had a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that could have wiped us off the map in 20, 30 minutes. Now we don't have any real enemies, just a few ragtag guys who've already been rounded up in Iraq and Syria, ISIS.
Oh, but what about Iran? The president thinks Iran is our enemy, and it's a danger. And, you know, we've got to send troops and more aircraft carriers and stuff down there to maybe create a new war, if he could possibly do it. Of course, that's just rattling the keys to get people to look at something different besides himself. It would be perfect to get into some kind of a conflict in the Persian Gulf.
Well, I think he's conflicted. He's being pushed into it by the Saudis and possibly by Netanyahu, but certainly by the Saudis and by Bolton, his national security advisor, and by Pompeo, all hawks. But I think Trump's concerned, he's not entirely stupid, that a war in the Gulf would probably have gasoline prices go up to $10 a gallon, and that would hurt his reelection chances. So it would be my guess, Phil, that this is all sort of, you know, saber-rattling theater that's going on now, because they've already declared economic warfare on Iran, and Iran is literally being squeezed to the point where something's going to break.
Well, it's a distraction, too, you know. If you can distract people from looking at, you know, the stuff like his taxes and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
You distract people, then that's how he operates. That's why he's on his tweeting all the time on Twitter constantly, is to distract people and sling stuff out that the media will pick up and run with in an opposite direction from what's really going on.
Sure, it's government by stunt because he doesn't know how to govern, so he pulls these reality TV stunts on a daily basis. But just in closing, though, my sense is that he probably, if he does do a war with Iran, it'll be in October of 2020, just before the elections.
Yes, I think you're probably right, and that's another reason for us to call out veterans who know about war, or maybe have been in war, or maybe served alongside people who were in war and who know better and know what war is really like, to get out and speak out against the actions of this horrible person that we call President of our United States now.
Well, Dr. Philip Butler, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this Memorial Day.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, who's a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his Navy career in 1981 as a professor of management at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today, Phil is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the release of the unrepentant so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind, from prison.
Soldier of the cross. Soldier of the cross, you carry the sword of fate. Soldier of the cross, soldier of the cross, you bring love to those who hate. You bring love to those who hate.
And until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion.
be pursued, but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now on this Memorial Day is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hey, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us, Robert, and I wanted to talk to you about Trump's plans or intentions, as far as we know, to pardon a number of people that are effectively charged with being war criminals. There's been a lot of pushback within the military against this and from the veteran running for president on the Democratic ticket, Mayor Pete Buttigieg. But since you were in Afghanistan in the early part of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, and of course it's turned out to be America's longest war, about 18 years later. But describe what happened where you were filming a bunch of Taliban prisoners were in a kind of an old fort in the bunker, and we all saw the footage, and there was a CIA officer that was killed by them. And then when they hauled these guys out from the dungeons where they were holed up, one of them turned out to be the so-called American Taliban, John Walker Lind, who just was released from prison last week. But you actually, when he was hauled out and he was wounded, my understanding is that he bunked with you that first night after the Special Forces medics had patched him up a little. So what? Tell us about your interactions with this guy. What did you learn from this extraordinary traumatic experience? And of course, a lot of people are angry that Johnny Spann, the CIA guy, is dead, and this guy is out free.
Yeah, well, people should remember that I've been in war since the mid-90s with jihadi groups, including al-Qaeda. And John Walker Lind was actually the second Irish-American jihadi that I had met. I had gone into Chechnya with a fellow named Akil Collins, who was in blue-eyed, red-haired jihadi who trained at the same camp that Lynn did. So when these people were in the basement of Kali Jangi, the battle raged for 2 or 3 days, and then they held out for a week in the basement. They were brought to me so I could interview them, and I interviewed them, but they were wounded and they were dying. And in the back was John Walker Lynn hiding, and I said, we'll take him to the hospital. So in the hospital is where you see that interview. So in my conversation with Lynn, my major concern was that he was going to disappear because they were snapping up members of al-Qaeda in their search for bin Laden. And I was with General Dostum, and General Dostum had a Special Forces ODA, which are now famous as the horse soldiers, but I was with them in early 2001 in combat. So my conversation, which was then broadcast on CNN, was at first sort of very distant to me because I was in Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, the news desk at CNN thought I was pulling his leg when I said I just found an American jihadi and had an interview with him, because he just thought, yeah, whatever. And then he immediately called me back. He says, is that the guy? So I never got the impact of how America viewed John Walker Lind, but it was an American all covered with soot and telling America to go screw themselves. So I imagine it caused quite a stir. Now, at that time, I was very comfortable in making the decision that John Walker Lind was a member of al-Qaeda, because he trained at Al-Farouq, which is bin Laden's camp. He was an Arabic speaker. He didn't speak Pashtun or Dari. And he had traveled from Yemen to Pakistan to Afghanistan to help in what they call Ansar, or the 055 Brigade, which, again, was a military unit paid for by Osama bin Laden. The media somehow obsessed with the Taliban, because they were quite popular at that time in documentaries, called him a Taliban. But he was never a member of the Afghan Taliban.
So he was working directly for bin Laden.
Correct. And so when I went to see him, you know, the concern always is in combat when people are wounded or dying, is you always give them first aid first. And in this particular case, it was an American, so I wanted to document who this person was, because Al-Qaeda's core tactic is deceit. You know, they were blowing themselves up with grenades that they tied around their necks, and they were giving themselves false names. So I was more concerned about if this guy was an American. He might not be an American, but who he was. And you can see the interview in which I reach out to him and say, hey, do you want to call your parents? Or I brought him a medic, and then I figured that he was not safe in that small clinic, so I brought him back to the house we were staying at, and one of the Special Forces soldiers, Bill Bennett, gave up his bed for him, and the next morning they trundled him off to the CIA at the Turkish school. So that was my interaction with him.
Well, what do you make of reports that he's not rehabilitated in the sense that he's still a pretty hardcore jihadi?
Well, I think that's a fiction to think that people who spend a significant amount of time, I mean, this we're talking from the age 16 to when he was captured around 20, why would he change his views? He was mistreated by the U.S., particularly the Marines. He was held in a prison for his what he felt was his political or religious beliefs. And now his only claim to infamy is really to retain those beliefs and sort of become like his role model, Bin Laden.
Well, apparently he ministered in prison. Was he a Muslim chaplain? I'm not sure of the details. But
you can lead prayers. I mean, it's not that formal, but
yeah.
He actually joined a lawsuit to allow prisoners to pray in groups, and he can, you know, he wrote letters to my friend Graham Wood at the Atlantic expressing his support for ISIS, even though he wasn't really on the outside. Mm-hmm. And I bumped into people who had done translations for various intelligence services with him, and he was absolutely keeping the same path that he started on the age of 16.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurists. Let's turn to President Trump's musing over pardoning a bunch of essentially war criminals, Navy SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher, one of them, and also an Army major as well, Major Matt Gulston. But he's already pardoned. You mentioned earlier he's pardoned 10 men so far, and a number of them have been vets. So let's go through that list.
In the past, President Trump has made outlandish statements that when people get to him and say, hey, that wasn't really a great idea, he has a habit of rolling them back. So we don't have any hard evidence of what he's about to do, but we do know that he has pardoned some rather controversial figures. And these were people that were brought to him by people with direct contact to President Trump. So there's no reason to disbelieve that he's about to pardon some very, very high profile, some of them convicted, but all of them fairly senior officers in the military who have been turned in by their own people for conducting murders or doing things in the field that broke military law.
Well, Mayor Pete Buttigieg is running for president on the crowded Democratic side. He was on a Fox News town hall, and he brought up the sort of notion of Trump. He was deeply offended by the idea that these people were going to be pardoned. And I imagine, since you spend so much time with the military, what's going on within the military ranks? I've seen a few generals. In fact, the guy that led the group that got Bin Laden was recently making statements of pretty passionate objection to these potential pardons. What's your reading on how the military see what Trump is doing?
So in the military, you have two things. It's trust and standards. So when you're on the ground and you're, you know, 100 yards from an enemy bunker and you're calling in an airstrike, you assume that pilot has certain standards and will do certain things within certain codes. You can't have sort of random acts of violence within the military. So that's the bedrock. Secondly is a code of conduct. And as a code of conduct, you can't lie, you can't cheat, you can't steal. You can't even misfire your weapon. So there are extremely draconian rules for anybody who breaks those. And we're talking from the lowest recruit up to the most senior general. in this particular list that has been put forward, these are people, some of them, one gentleman, Goldstein, is a graduate of West Point. He's a major. You have a 19-year veteran who's a chief petty officer. And these people have been turned in by their own people or self-confessed what they did as a crime. So there's no confusion in these cases that something criminal happened. And, of course, the JAG and the lawyers and the various processes that the military have are very stringent in tracking down whether wrongdoing was done. The only thing that bothers me is that Trump doesn't understand this, that every American who puts faith in the military and the standards that we create now will see that these standards don't apply. And that, to me, is very corrosive.
Well, doesn't it also apply that if you violate the laws of war and the Geneva Convention, then your own guys and girls can be tortured and mistreated? I mean, isn't that pretty fundamental?
Yeah, but that we know that we're past that. I mean, a good example is Goldstein. So Major Goldstein was a sterling example of a military officer in Special Forces, and he was involved in Marja. And if you remember Marja, the idea was to do hearts and minds, go into this town, get rid of the Taliban, bring in governance, you know, bring peace and trust and understanding. So when this gentleman snuck out at night to assassinate someone and then burn his body, you can imagine how that destroys that trust that we're trying to build. In the case of the SEAL, you had a guy whose entire team lined up to say, look, this guy's a bad apple. This guy has been doing horrible things to civilians, which not only is against the law, but it degrades our whole safety, you know, in the war zone. So there's no zero confusion on whether these people should be convicted or not. The worst one is the rumor that he might be letting the Nicholas Slatin off. And he, if you remember correctly, he was the lead shooter in the Blackwater Nisser Square event.
Right.
And again, you have a guy who's tried three times. And you may or may not agree with, you know, the situation or the political tone of what happened. But a gentleman who's been tried three times for murder, you know, pardoning him sends a very bizarre message to people who we are currently working with in the Middle East.
Well, one of the people that he's pardoned is a guy called Christian Marc Saussier. He's a Navy sailor. He took pictures of a classified propulsion system on a Navy submarine, which is highly secretive. And Trump pardoned him because he'd written complaints about saying what he did was no worse than what Hillary Clinton did with her private email server. So it looks as if Trump let him off because of his statements about Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I imagine these secret propulsion systems are pretty highly classified, aren't they?
Yeah, of course. And you can go down the road with WikiLeaks, et cetera, et cetera. But this was an absolutely political move. And the same with Joe Arpaio. You know, Joe Arpaio was a very polarizing figure, but he was caught and convicted, and he was pardoned as part of a political message. And then Scooter Libby is my favorite, because Scooter Libby, you know, broke the law, but he throws back to the old Bush neocon world. So it seems that these are not travesties of justice that are being looked into by a legal panel, and maybe there was a bad conviction. These are pure political messages going out to his constituency, but also eroding the rule of law in America and our opinion of us overseas.
Well, there's another layer there that's worth looking into, and that is the fact that the Navy SEAL, Chief Eddie Gallagher, he's being represented by a lawyer for the Trump Organization, Mark Mukasey, and the former NYPD Commissioner Bernard Kerik, who's also a business partner of Trump's and one of his surrogates on Fox News. And apparently there's a Fox News reporter called Pete Hegseth that's encouraging Trump for these pardons. So what's going on there? Are these the sort of chicken hawk, red-blooded patriots on television?
Well, you know, they used to make fun of low-information voters, you know, back in the day. And I think, without a lot of Google ability or the just the few seconds of looking into the actual cases, on the surface, you're convicting a patriotic American soldier who served his country, et cetera, et cetera. If you go just one level below that, these people are actually being turned in by their fellow patriotic soldiers and convicted by patriotic soldiers. So it's a very superficial political message, and I hope he reconsiders. I hope there's enough backlash that when he does announce what he's going to do on Monday, that he looks at the impact on all our serving officers and enlisted men who do live by the rules.
Well, it's interesting talking about this, Robert Young-Pelton, because my own brother is an investigative journalist in Australia, and he broke the story that an Australian SAS, you know, that's the Special Forces, war hero who got the Victoria Cross, which is the highest military honor that the British give out and the Australians, like the Congressional Medal of Honor. And this guy was turned in by his own SAS fellow soldiers because he was a war criminal, you know, an old farmer. They landed the helicopters in a field in Afghanistan and a little plot, you know, which the guy and his family depend upon, and the rotors of the helicopters thrashed all of the crop. And the old farmer was basically, you know, saying, you know, you got to compensate me. I've lost this season's crop. And this guy just shot him dead and tossed kids out of helicopters. Did really bad stuff. But guess what's happening to my brother? Rupert Murdoch is defending this guy because he's like, same with the mentality of Fox News. And in Australia, it's the equivalent of Murdoch, Fox News owning CBS, NBC, and ABC. He's got a complete monopoly on the media there, except for two newspapers, one of which is being sued, where my brother broke the story, the Sydney Morning Herald and the Melbourne Age. But because of the libel laws, which are the same as the British libel laws, which go back to the, you know, Tom Paine and the Founding Fathers chafing against these very, very libel laws in order to have a revolution. They couldn't publish anything. The long and the short of it is that he's being sued for defamation along with the libel case, and he could lose everything because Murdoch is, and this other media baron are on this jihad because they were stupid enough to hire this guy because he was a war hero. It turns out he's a war criminal, so this is happening. It's very much a mirror of what we're talking about.
Yeah, you're seeing the separation between what the voters think and versus what the leader does. And the leader, in this case, in Trump's case, is taking care of his own interests, whether it's business interests or deals with dictators to sell weapons, and using the tools that were sort of lightly used in the past to just barrel through any objection from Congress. So I don't know. I guess the trigger point will be 2020 when people go out and vote and decide whether he should be returned as president. But it is alarming to see what I would consider to be abuse of power, even though it's not illegal, in doing these pardons. And most presidents do it on their way out. You know, like Mark Rich and people like that were pardoned in sort of the flurry of packing things up and getting out of the White House by Clinton. Trump seems to enjoy sticking this to the voters.
Well, I think he enjoys things that he can actually do as a president without having to deal with Congress, you know. So he can write an executive order, he can impose tariffs, and he can pardon people. So it's a tool or a toy that he can play with. But just in the last couple of minutes, how does all of this relate to the enormous amount of money we're spending on defense? We have a Secretary of State now who's literally comes from Boeing. He represents a contractor, and he's, you know, and there's always been a tension in the military between the toys and the boys. Well, now I guess it's the toys and the boys and girls, that now we have a representative of the toys. Are the boys getting and the girls getting shortchanged?
Here's what the most alarming thing that's happened in the last few months was the false flag lead up to this arms sale, this $8.1 billion arms transfer, which required an emergency directive from Trump to break through Congress's block. If you go back a few weeks, you remember there were a bunch of attacks in Fujairah in the UAE on oil tankers.
Right.
And there were very, very strange photos posted, and suddenly Bolton ramped up the security profile, and Pompeo made emergency trips, and we thought we were marching off to war with Iran, but it turns out he was just doing the point so that he could say, this is an emergency, and we need to get these weapons immediately to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which is for their use in the war in Yemen. It had nothing to do with Iran. But we're seeing a lot of abuse of executive power, and putting people who are compliant in lead positions, as you mentioned, you know, the former head of Boeing. Even when you look at the environmental aspects and the legal and education aspects, these are people who have an agenda, who are submissive to Trump, who want to get things done efficiently, but it's just angering a lot of people to see that abuse of power.
Well, do you think that, I mean, as much as Bolton and MBZ and MBS and perhaps Netanyahu and Pompeo want a war in the Gulf against Iran, Trump doesn't seem to want, he seems to understand that that would probably, you know, spike the price of gas to about 10 bucks a gallon, and that wouldn't help him in a re-election. How do you think that's going to play out? Do you think Trump will pull off a little wag-the-dog war just before the election in October of 2020, assuming he's still around?
I think there's been a constant pressure on Trump to start a conflict with Iran using proxies, which would be Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and you've seen that ever since the election, their influence on Trump. But what you see Trump doing is, like in Venezuela or Libya, he stirs things up, and then when it gets serious, he just drops it like a new kid with an old toy and moves on to the next thing. And this is probably far more destructive. It creates countries like Libya or Syria that are just messes, actually, than having a war. So he's not going to go into a conflict with Iran like Iraq or Afghanistan. But he has the capability to cause extreme instability and extreme damage to both Americans and the countries he's messing with.
Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you very much for joining us on this Memorial Day. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine, has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi rebel and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door, took the kids to the park and disappeared by